Welcome to Red Meat, a collection of the tastiest tidbits from Odyssey's conservative news talk radio stations across the country, a place where we're not afraid to dig in. Let's kick things off with the questions that are arising about convicted sex offender Jeffrey Epstein's alleged client list of wealthy men he helped to procure underage girls for. Why are we talking about it? Because Attorney General Pam Bondi mentioned having the client list ready to review. But now the Department of Justice stepped in suddenly to say no further investigations will be conducted and no information will be released. Here's more with Tara Servatius at WORD Radio.
Yeah. Meanwhile, Roger, the Epstein weirdness, it's really weird. Did you see what a member of the Trump administration told the Rolling Stone?
Yes.
Quote, yeah. They're going to be so mad. This is the headline. Trump administration braces for MAGA revolt over Epstein memo. They're going to be so mad.
So mad, yeah.
But, hey, no, what Johns? Johns? No, there were no Johns. You did not see all the most famous people in the world on the Epstein plane. You thought you did, but you did not. They were not there, and they didn't fly to Little St. John Island. They didn't at all, even though you saw them on that plane there flying to Little St. John Island like Bill Clinton over and over and over and over again. But it didn't happen. So, anyway, okay, here's the problem. When you tell a lie this big, Roger, and that's what they're doing, Pam Bondi, for whatever reason, Dan Bongino, Cash Patel, when you tell a lie this big, you can't cover all the threads of it. Let me give you an example, okay? Jim Hoft at the Gateway Pundit sued. This was after the Ghislaine Maxwell case, sued to open the files to find out who the Johns were, right?
Mm-hmm.
It's been going on since 2022.
Yeah, 22.
Okay. Now, here's where it gets weird. They wanted the men and the women's names, with whom Epstein traded sex with minors for favors or money or both.
Mm-hmm.
At the time in 2022, no other media outlet in the country had petitioned the court to unseal the identities of Epstein's clients. It was almost like the corporate media was protecting the disgusting sexual predators, Jim Hoff writes yesterday. But listen to this. Back in July 2022, the Gateway Pundit lawyers Mark Randazza and Jay Woman of the Randazza Legal Group, along with GP General Counsel John Burns, filed a motion to intervene in Guffrey versus Maxwell case, United States District Court of New York. But they were blocked from getting the records, from unsealing the records. And why was that? An anonymous John Doe, literally styled by his lawyer as John Doe, filed an objection to the Gateway Pundit unsealing the sex client list.
Okay. John Doe, of course.
John Doe?
Yeah.
Was on it.
Of course.
He was on it. And he was not Jeffrey Epstein because Jeffrey's dead.
Yeah.
He either did or did not kill himself. So regardless, we all agree he's dead, right?
Yeah.
So if we are told that the only John, all of these thousands of girls, they were sex trafficked only to Jeffrey Epstein, who's this guy?
Yeah.
And if an anonymous John Doe filed something in court.
Yeah, there should be a record somewhere.
To keep his own name hidden. And the court sided with the John Doe, who literally was a pedophile John, over the interests of the press and the public. Where is he?
Yeah.
I thought he wasn't there. What possible reason could John Doe have for not wanting the Epstein sex client list exposed? By the way, the courts, Lee, I mean, I'm sorry, Roger.
Hello.
I miss Lee. I wasn't right yesterday going home. I thought,
So do I. Every time the alarm goes off at 3:30 a.m.
Yeah, I know, really. He'll be back, though. He'll be back next week. Every once in a while, I call my husband Lee, and I call Lee by my husband's name. It's weird. He's my work husband. So here's the really weird thing, okay? He's like my dad, really, more, but don't tell him that. It'll make him feel old. We'll just call him my work husband.
Ouch.
Oh, he's not here. It doesn't matter.
Okay
sure. No one will tell him. So anyway, this is just me and you talking. So anyway, so the court sided with the John Doe, right?
Yeah.
Over the interest of the public in keeping the Epstein sex client list sealed. In other words, the court admitted it existed. And so this morning, everybody should read this article. This is Jim Hoft over at the Gateway Pundit. It's a great investigative operation. Here's the headline. Wait, what? If there was no Epstein client list, then why did New York courts refuse the Gateway Pundit's legal request for the list based on anonymous John Doe, who was on the list? Wow. He filed a motion.
Well, here's another possibility. You know, a lot of people are put in the ground all the time under the name John Doe.
Yeah. So these are the threads that when you tell a lie, the size of the lie, that Bongino and Bondi and Cash Patel
can't cover it up.
Yeah, they can't cover it up. There's too many pieces of it. Yeah. It's too big. It's too wide.
Somebody's going to cave.
Yeah. I don't know. The JFK stuff hasn't leaked. Not all of it anyway. And if you just wait 62 years, we'll know. You got plans to live that long?
Working
on it. Yeah, me too.
Is there a there when it comes to Epstein's client list? Mark Cox is skeptical about the claims made by Pam Bondi and others regarding the existence of an Epstein client list. And he's frustrated that no significant prosecutions have resulted from the Epstein case so far. Here's more.
Now if we could just find out who was on Jeffrey Epstein's list, we'd be in better shape, wouldn't we?
Man, I am so fascinated by that story now, but yeah. I'm just almost irritated because it just seems like it's back and forth. And now, obviously, people are frustrated with AG Bondi because they're saying you build this up and then it ends up being nothing. So I'm getting to the point where I'm not sure I fully trust what she's saying.
Yeah. Well, I mean, I do think they have some explaining to do about that. No doubt about it. And, you know, Leavitt handled it as well as she could when they asked her about it yesterday. But at the end of the day, they made a lot of noise about the fact that there's a list. And now suddenly there's no there. It's just weird. And here's the thing about it. I could get on the radio right now and name names, because there are lists out there, people who were supposedly on the list, but some of those people, if they're not public figures, you could slander them by claiming that they, suggesting that they did something wrong because you know their name was on a flight manifest to that island. Maybe they just flew there and laid on the beach. Who knows?
I'm sure.
But we know what went on at that island. It's like going to a Diddy party.
What does Ghislaine, I always want to, is that how you say your name?
Ghislaine Maxwell.
Uh-huh. What does she know? She's sitting in a jail cell.
Something that's keeping her alive is what she knows. And I'm shocked that she's not worked out a deal to get out of jail.
She's where? There for like 20 more years
I
or
think
something
so.
Like that?
Something like yeah. that. There's no way that only she and Jeffrey Epstein were the ones guilty of whatever it is that they did on that island. There's just no way it was just those two. And anybody else who participated in it should have a scarlet letter branded onto their mm-hmm. chests. But they must be powerful enough that they've been able to avoid that. There were people that just want this to go away. And I don't understand it. Let's put it this way. If we can't get to the bottom of it with Donald Trump in the White House, we're never going to get to the bottom of it. And I think Pam Bondi is going to have to appear on a TV station somewhere, a TV program, and explain why she said, I've got the list on my desk. We've heard people say, you're not going to believe it. Wait till this list is released. Now we're told there's no list. Those two things can't be true. Both of those things can't be true. So I'm all in on the criticism on this one. I'm not a Candace Owens fan these days. She's burned too many bridges with me. But she did say, famously, right after Cash Patel and others promised the list, you will never see a list, mark my words. And she's apparently right on this one. She's not right on Israel, but she's right on this one. I'll have to give her credit where credit is due.
It's sitting on my desk right now to review. That's been a directive by President Trump. I'm reviewing that. I'm reviewing JFK files, MLK files. That's all in the process of being reviewed because that was done at the directive of the president from all of these agencies.
So that was Pam Bondi, the attorney general, right after they got sworn into office. And how do I know that? Well, I watched it and I played that bite here and I was so excited because I thought, hey, that's Pam Bondi. That's the new attorney general. She's standing in front of the White House. She says that on her desk is the list of Jeffrey Epstein's flight list or people the people that flew to Epstein Island with Jeffrey Epstein, where probably many things happened that you could never talk about on broadcast radio. And yet the DOJ had this information all along, and there haven't been more prosecutions. That's a head scratcher to me. Every single one of those people should be deposed and ask under oath what they saw and witnessed and took part in at Epstein Island. And before long, a few of them would turn state's witness and say, I saw blankety blank over there with a 15-year-old girl, because you know that's what was going on there. He was flying women and maybe children for all we know. Maybe male and female, for all we know. The females have been the one we've heard about the most. But those are the ones that got the most publicity. But who knows what all went on there? Somebody knows. Ghislaine Maxwell knows, but she's kept her mouth shut because apparently she wants to remain among the living. How powerful are the forces behind keeping this quiet? If Pam Bondi, after making a statement like that, is now claiming there's no there there, how can that be a thing?
Have you seen anything that you said, oh my gosh?
Not yet.
Okay.
So she kind of hinted that not yet has she seen anything that made her go, oh my gosh. But suddenly, Kash Patel and Dan Bongino are declaring firmly that Epstein killed himself, and there's nothing else to say here. So I don't know. It's a head scratcher. It's a head scratcher to Tom Fitton, because he's been leading the charge. And he says it's hard for him to believe as well. Go to cut number 8 for me,
Ethan. I don't know. I read the memo 3 or 4 times again this morning, and it's really, I don't think even the Biden administration would have written anything like this.
That's pretty damning to have Tom Fitton say that, right? I hope they come out at some point. I hope the president addresses this. I hope Bongino and Patel address it. Because here's the thing. Your credibility will only go so far with people who listen to, for sure, Dan Bongino on his syndicated radio show for many years, claiming that Epstein didn't kill himself. And all of a sudden, he's admitting Epstein killed himself. And Kash Patel, for that matter, was out there on every podcast and broadcast he could get onto talking about he's going to lift the cover off all this stuff. And now we're told there's nothing. I don't know about you, Kim. I don't buy it. And I'm not quite sure that we'll ever get to the bottom of this. I think it's going to disappoint a lot of people in MAGA land.
Oh, it already has.
Yes.
It's a lot of teasing and acting like there's some big, you know, explosive list we're about to get. And so everyone's kind of waiting with bated breath, and then it's just nothing. So then it's just more frustrating.
Remember how we felt after the big investigation into Hillary Clinton, and we knew she had handled top secret information on unsecure communications. Remember that? I joked at the time, I'm like, we're never going to get to the bottom of this. I'm like, the powers that be will pull strings to make sure she never sees a day behind bars. And sure enough, it was none other than James Comey who, while admitting that she was completely guilty of this, finally refused to recommend charges against her, saying he didn't believe a jury would ever convict her, even though they had all kinds of evidence.
Secretary Clinton said, I did not email any classified material to anyone on my email. There is no classified material. Was that true?
Now, there was classified material emailed.
Secretary Clinton said she used just one device. Was that true?
She used multiple devices during the 4 years of her term as Secretary of State.
Secretary Clinton said all work-related emails were returned to the State Department. Was that true?
No, we found work-related emails, thousands, that were not returned.
Yeah, that's when I said I feel like Charlie Brown and Lucy, and she pulls the football away at the last minute, and here we go again.
Now let's move on from Epstein to other crimes, murders in particular. Newell Norman at WWL Radio in New Orleans breaks down a shocking new statistic about how many of them go unsolved. How can it be? Let's find out. Take it away, Newell.
Folks, there was a recent article in the New York Times that talked about that nearly half of all murderers, those that are committing murder, get away with it in this country. It's a flip of a coin as to whether or not they're going to be arrested. And when we compare ourselves to our peer countries around the world, we find that we fall far behind in the clearance rates. Joining us to talk about this topic is Ronald Serpas, professor of practice in the Department of Criminal Justice at Loyola and former NOPD chief. Ronnie, welcome to the show.
Hey, Noel, how are you? It's good to be with you today.
Doing well, Ronnie. I was surprised to read this article, actually, in the New York Times. It's not a conservative rag by any stretch of the imagination. It's something that you and I have been talking about for a long time here. You know, human capital matters, technology matters, and the list goes on and on. Your reaction to this New York Times article?
Well, it's like most media articles. They don't have enough words available in their article to talk about really the depth of the issue. From about 2004 to 2019, the murder clearance rate, which means someone was arrested or someone who could have been arrested was not able to, often because they've expired or they're in a prison. That's the measure that the FBI uses. From 2004 to 2019, it was steady in the nation around 60 to 66% year in and year out. Obviously, it took a drop during COVID. But in the last couple of years, when it dropped to the 50s with COVID, it's starting to move back up again. Now, that helps the listeners have a general feel. But, Newell, something you and I used to talk about on the radio when we was working continues to be the case. Solid academic research and solid governmental data tells us that when all the things that can be known about a murder are known, 70 to 80% of the victims knew or had some relationship with the person who killed them. So when people say that murders are not being cleared higher than, let's say, to meet that 70 or 80%, and this is where you and I, our experience would help people, it's often because everybody knows who did it, but nobody's talking. Nobody wants to cooperate for whatever reasons, or they're afraid to cooperate. So during your time as sheriff and my time as chief, we started relying more on Crime Stoppers so we could get information from people who were afraid to talk for their own life. We started relying more on the incredible intelligence center that you created in JP that we partnered with you. We're relying more now on video technology, on digital forensics of phones and infotainment system of cars. But the real problem there in our communities, and when people like to compare us to other nations, is that research and the data indicate 70 to 80% of murder victims had some relationship with their victim, and somehow or another, those relationships are not coming to the government to solve the murder of that person.
Yeah, the other thing that the article points out, when, you know, in my thought process, when you have these relational murders like that, it's not a question of if so much of when, right? There's a conflict, and the conflict's going to get resolved, and it's not going to be through some conflict resolution technique. It's going to be what they know how to do on the street. So whether you put a gun in the hand of the perpetrator or a knife or some other instrumentality, I'm not necessarily sure that it would matter here in this country. They try to make a case it's because of access to guns. Maybe, but
that's crazy.
I'm not completely convinced by that at all. Your thoughts?
No, I'm not convinced by that either, and I only have 45 years of experience, and you, believe it or not, I think getting close to 50 years of experience. People who use guns to kill people generally don't care about the law anyway. Is that fair to say?
Yes, I think so.
Oh, I hit you with the 50, bro? Oh, I'm sorry.
With the 50, bro. Yeah.
You think people didn't know?
But no, you're right.
My real experience is clear. People who have moments of lost control and kill someone are very rare compared to the ones where people were searching for the victim they wanted to kill. And as a result, those people don't care about the law of guns. They got a gun. They're going to kill the person they're looking for. And that eats up a tremendous number of the raw number of cases. When you get outside of the cities of 500,000, here's another thing, Noah. When you look at the data, cities over 500,000 have always had a lower clearance rate than cities under 500,000 and lower than cities that are a quarter of a million. And that's because those cities are smaller, the relationships are tighter and closer, and they tend not to be. And I know a lot of people might not want to hear this, and I know you would agree with me. In these smaller cities, you're not seeing as much of this gang turf warfare, group warfare, where I'm going to kill so-and-so because I saw him on Bourbon Street. I shot him in Baton Rouge. The guy survived. Now I'm going to shoot him on Bourbon Street, and I'm going to hit 10, 12 other people in the crowd when I shoot at him. That generally doesn't happen in cities that are much smaller than the urban centers.
No, no doubt. I mean, and, you know, and it's not even really what we would think about the traditional organized gang. A lot of these are just loosely connected relationships that are had out there. But what it does do is drive the emotion, right? When you have three knuckleheads together as opposed to just one.
Absolutely. And yet they're also driven by no fear for who else they hurt. Now, here's something else that I think can sometimes agitate people who think it's about guns. When you and I were young cops a half a decade ago, if somebody was killed, it was one gun, one bullet, no mistakes. Today, and in the last 10, 12 years, because of the dynamics of groups and gangs and the unintended fear, they have no fear of shooting into a crowd of people. You see funerals where somebody's mad at somebody in the funeral, and they'll shoot 10, 12 people in the funeral trying to hit one guy. That's the difference. 50 years ago, I'm mad at Duel. I got a gun. I got one bullet, and he's going to be the only person shot. That these groups don't think like that.
Yeah. You know, it's interesting.
They don't care who else they shoot.
In the Times, there's always articles about over-incarceration, right? And that's what kind of moved me about this article. This was kind of a different approach where they said the lack of legal accountability emboldens criminals, leading to more crime and violence. You and I use the word selective incapacitation, the impact criminals getting them off the street and putting them in jail. We always compare our incarceration rates to these peer countries as well. And I'm always amused by the fact that we offend at a higher rate than they do in those countries. So why wouldn't they think we'd have more people in jail, even with our what is a pretty abysmal solution rate on many of these crimes?
Well, I think that, and I'm sure to incite anger by some audience members, if you compare one country to another country, that's not particularly methodologically sound. There's
right.
dramatic differences in cultures and societies and economies and single-family homes, single-family parents who aren't 18 yet. A lot of that doesn't replicate in these other countries that certain factions want to say, oh, if we were only like them. Well, here's one for you. If you look at the rate in which people are stabbed in the United Kingdom, it's pretty damn scary. We don't have a lot of stabbings in this country, so that would be a crazy comparison. Because you really are comparing Maseratis and Volkswagens. There are two completely different notions. So I get a little bit agitated when these do-gooders who say, if we only had the crime rate of Sweden, well, maybe Sweden doesn't have as much single-family homes or the destruction of the nuclear family we have. Maybe Sweden doesn't have this, and maybe we don't have what they have. So quit trying to compare them. They don't have a Second Amendment in Sweden. Get over it. Just get over it. It is what it is.
So when we talk about, and I know that you interact with a lot of folks that are still in the business on a daily basis, What are you hearing from them? I mean, you know, one of the observations in the article, it says, why does America solve so few crimes? And it says that experts point to five explanations. A lack of attention and resources. That, you know, we've spent more time on enhanced sentencing as opposed to giving other resources more in line with solving the crime.
I think you and I would agree, as practitioners, as in human beings, when an individual makes a mistake, we want to give them a break. But it's a foolhardy task to think that people who are committing these gangland-style murders in America, they woke up that day and said, I'm going to commit my first crime ever today, and I'm going to kill somebody and shoot four or five other people in the process because they were in the way. It's just nonsensical. When people are in this stage of their life, be it good, bad, or indifferent, they have lost touch with social norms and social rules. It's one of the reasons, if you remember the call-in sessions that we were all doing and I think had a lot of good outcomes, but they could not have perfect outcomes because the time you're talking to a 22-year-old person who's been in and out of the CJ system, who doesn't have a nuclear family, who has no idea who his real family is bombed out of the education system, is bombed out of the economy, they're generally not going to change too much because they can't. That's not the same as a 17-year-old kid who steals a car one time and says, my God, I'll never do it again as long as I live. And that's why they conflate these issues, because by conflating them, it confuses the casual listener to say, oh, my goodness, why aren't we giving people chances? You and I know a half a decade versus 45 years, a half a century, that people who are shooting people have been in a lot of trouble in their life, unless it's a intimate personal violence thing, which is very sad. Wouldn't you agree? People who are shooting each other on the streets in Harvey and East New Orleans have been in a lot of trouble and have refused the assistance of the criminal justice system.
Well, we have generational crime families, too. I mean, they've been involved.
What's the name of the one on Simon Bolivar?
Yeah, I mean, they've been involved for years and years and years. I mean, and, you know, it hasn't changed. You've used the term nuclear family a lot, and that is one of the primary differences. I was just in Croatia, and I was curious because there's, like, no crime there. I mean, it's absolutely incredible. And I was talking to a driver that we had, and I said, what do you think is the one issue about that, why that's not the case here? And he goes, we don't want to bring disrespect on our family.
That's right. Could you ask him, you tell me how you asked him that in Croatian?
Not very well, but thankfully he spoke fluent English. But you know what's interesting? You know, he said, here we live together still. So he's in his 30s, he's married, he has two children, he lives on the third floor of the family, you know, structure. His parents live on the first floor, and his brother lives on the second floor with her spouse and their children. They have meals every night together, you know, and he goes, we would never bring, a situation where we would embarrass our family, because it's all about family. And interesting there, also, no property taxes, right? Because they want the property to remain in the family line. And they don't want home ownership to be a burden there. Very much in tune to cultivating the strong family. And it works. Ronnie, I was there 15 days, saw two policemen.
Oh, my goodness.
Just two. That was it. Traveled to 15 different cities and saw two policemen the whole time I was there. I mean, it was like, you and I, we walk around and we're looking for these things, right, instead of just relaxing. But that's all there was.
Well, remember, we looked for police so hard we had to put yellow vests on them so we could see them.
But, you know, and we wonder, you know, why we have these differences. And it's pretty easy. It's pretty clear. And I just got a text. It's the same way in Italy. Yes, it is. I mean, I was in Italy. I saw more policemen in Italy, but not that many.
Well, and they try to make some people will try to make the argument and turn it into a racial argument because it inflames people's passions. Put it all aside. In our careers, I have seen white families that have fallen apart and black families that have fallen apart. It didn't matter what the race was. It mattered that the family fell apart. that the children didn't have stable influences. There's a lot of criminological theory about why crime happens, but people like myself in this particular field, I like to study the theories about why crime does not happen, control theories. And they're all based upon families and communities raising children to have commitments and expectations and determination. So at the end of the day, it's not about race. It doesn't matter whether it's black or white. If you got kids who are being able to tell their mom and them that they're going out to start their day at midnight, it ain't a good thing. And as Chuck Ramsey, a good friend of mine, said all the time, if you're waiting for the government to raise your children, that ain't going to go well. It's true. No. It's just truisms.
Well, I mean, how many other things do they do well? Not many, but, you know. So when we talk about resource allocation, let's bring it back to resource allocation. Do you, in what you're hearing today from leaders in law enforcement, is the tide starting to turn where they really want to make these investments in technologies that are going to really help catch the bad guys?
Yeah, absolutely. And the consultancy work we do in departments, the biggest departments in the country and the smallest departments, it is always going to be if technology can make us more efficient to serve the public, we should do it. And yes, you see in tremendous investments in digital forensics units. You see in huge investments in clearing up DNA backlogs. But those all cause work, right? I'm not saying they don't stop work. They create work. We're seeing more and more use. Oh, speaking about why don't we be like other countries? Well, other countries in the world use facial recognition to solve crimes and make people safe. We're still having a political debate over it here in this country. So, yes. And I also think we're starting to see a little bit of a treading water on the larger departments in the country being able to at least stop much of the attrition loss and kind of hold even. The good news is they're kind of holding even now. The bad news is they're still significantly shorter than they were. And the final point to your question is a resource allocation. When you were sheriff and I was chief, we're going to solve murders. And we're going to put on it whatever we can to get that done. And we're going to solve sexual assault. And we're going to put everything on it to get it done. But as governments begin to suck out the resources of policing, you end up creating the dynamic where the community gets very disenchanted with you because you're not coming to the car burglaries anymore. You're not coming to the bicycle theft, which in 90% of the citizens, that's the biggest crime they'll ever have in their life. And because of the staffing division decisions, good or bad, the citizens start to feel very disenfranchised from the police department, like, well, my crime was important to me, so it's a bit of a circle that we're still seeing around the country. If you ever hear somebody say they're going to do call mitigation in 911 centers, what that really means is we're going to tell people we're coming to less of what you ask us about, and that separates us in a way that doesn't help.
Yeah, I don't know that you could ever restore or maintain public trust and confidence by call mitigation strategies.
You're right.
I've always said that the hallmark of the success of the JPSO was response time to all crimes. It didn't matter. Because the vast majority of people will never interact with police. But if it is an interaction, it's typically going to be calling 911 because somebody's pulling door handles, stealing bikes, criminal damage or otherwise. And when they call, they want you there, plain and simple.
Absolutely. And, you know, we used to hear a little bit a couple years ago that, you know, these kids running around breaking people's car windows, that's not such a big deal. I think the mayor might have said that, just throwing it out there. And the problem with that is if somebody breaks your car window, you lose a day of work because you got to go to Safelite and get your window replaced. It's not just simply the acts of juvenile truants, but the issue there for me and you is that now you've made sure a citizen doesn't think you care about what happened to them. And they're the ones paying the freight, and that's a bad place to be. And luckily, and good reason, the NOPD's Citizen Satisfaction Survey done independently by the Crime Coalition is starting to get some better connectivity between the community and the police, and that's great. Sheriffs, and you and I've talked about this a lot, even over alcoholic beverages, sheriffs have to have a more in-tuned relationship to that kind of data because it's part and parcel to how they make sure they're serving. And police chiefs do it, but they have to do it through the prism of some other political process that might not see it as important. Fortunately, in Nashville, both of the mayors I worked for and the governor I worked for in Washington, they believed in that survey data. They said, man, this helps us do it. So you're right. You've got to make sure people are happy, or they're going to tell their friends not to cooperate.
We talked briefly about across the pond and how they police there. My perspective, and I know you have more recent interaction with folks, are we anywhere close to like their camera technology that they utilize, separate and apart from facial recognition, just cameras itself? It seems as though 20 years ago, 25 years ago, they started with CCTV everywhere, like in England, and it moved to other European countries. And we seem to be way behind the eight ball in comparison with them. Is that still kind of the case?
I think we've closed the gap some, because the real-time crime centers that have been popping up all over America, I visited one a couple weeks ago in Fairfax County, Virginia. Fairfax County, Virginia is a community of over a million people, and they have a real-time crime center that's probably one of the best I've seen in the country. And they are able to jump into public cameras. They're able to jump into business cameras. They have citizens who turn over their address of their camera, not their camera video, but their address, so the police can go knock on doors. We were doing that in New Orleans even. I think we're getting better at it. And I guess one of the differences is, and except for maybe, you know, like New York and Chicago and maybe other places I'm not that familiar with, we don't have the infrastructure of public transportation like England does. So in a way, it would be easier for them to start stringing up a bunch of cameras, whereas we don't really have as much of that in cities outside of maybe New York or Chicago. But to your question, yes, the real-time crime centers that are popping up in departments of all size, they're taking better access to that information and using it.
Yeah.
Not nearly to the extent they do over there, I agree with you.
Yeah. One of the other things, and I don't
think
most people...
at the Capitol, remember? They use facial recognition to identify people at the Capitol on January 6th. And you got some cities that are still saying you can't use facial recognition. And, no, you and I have talked about this, and you're a lawyer. Please remind the audience, facial recognition is like a fingerprint. It's like DNA. It just says who you might be. You don't get a charge for your face like that. You don't get a charge.
No,
and,
it's just
and the
part
politicization
of
this, even in New Orleans, they're still politicizing this, right? What magistrate would sign a warrant with only a facial recognition or only a fingerprint? Nobody. Nobody.
Well, we would hope nobody, but there have been instances where, you know, we have people that just, they don't stay abreast of technology, how it interacts with the law, what it means. You know, we view these jobs as being mailbox money. You know, we just show up to pick up the check, you know, and you got to work hard every day. Every day is an opportunity to learn, you know, and if you're not learning something every day, then you're less than. And if you're the leader of the organization, your organization is going to be less than. Right. I mean, we all know that. Go ahead. Ryan,
well, and back to the point. Yeah, we're back to what we were just saying just a few seconds ago. The public watches this, and if they don't think you're keeping up and if they don't think you're doing the best you can to help them, they turn off. And when they turn off, a lot of things can go bad.
No, there's no doubt about that. Worthwhile reading, I think. It's entitled Nearly Half of America's Murderers Get Away With It. New York Times article. German Lopez is the author. It was published on July the 6th. Thank you so much, Ronald Serpas, professor of practice in the Department of Criminal Justice at Loyola, for joining us today. Really appreciate your time, your insight. Have a great week, my friend.
Thank you for listening to this episode of Red Meat. Don't forget to smash that subscribe button for your favorite tasty assortment of conservative audio. And follow your local Odyssey talk station to get shows from these hosts delivered daily wherever you get your podcasts. Until next time, stay hungry.